Radio City back at it once again. John Grayson and Rob Ross, and feeling much better this time around. How about you, Rob?
I'm doing great. You know, it was the first day of Passover on Friday, which also started on Shabbos, to which I don't observe. Friday was also Good Friday, which I definitely don't observe. Today is, of course, Easter, which I don't observe. And it's also April Fool's Day. Add all of that up, and it's also Mercury retrograde. So there's some kind of major league cosmic joke happening, but to everybody who listens to this show, a very happy Passover and a happy Easter to you all.
That's right, and we just passed the first day of spring about a week ago, so yeah, we're right in the thick of it. Everything seems to be happening all at once, and of course, we celebrated Easter Sunday and April Fool's Day here in town with a little bit of snow. So, you know, just exactly what you need for spring, I think.
Which we're getting tomorrow, allegedly.
Yeah, allegedly.
So there you go. That's, it's on the cards for tomorrow. Speaking of the cards, so baseball season just began on Thursday. The Mets take 2 of 3 from your Cardinals.
Yep.
The Cardinals won today in very expected style, because I wasn't holding up too much hope with Steven Matz on the mound for the Mets. He didn't look particularly sharp out of the gate. He looked like he was rushing rather than focusing. And that's never a good sign. Plus, the bats were a little quiet today for the Mets. I also do have a problem with the home plate umpire of today's game, C.B. Buckner, who doesn't seem to have a set strike zone. And that went for both teams. Calls that they weren't getting, that they should have been getting. Just it was a very badly called game.
Right. Well, that'll happen early in the year.
But on the really bright side of things, the Yankees lost yet again in the bottom of the 8th inning to the Toronto Blue Jays with 2 out, the bases loaded, and you give up a grand slam. I love it. So the Yankees are 2-2, the Mets are 2-1. Unfortunately, the Nationals won again. How long that will last, who knows?
Right, and I'll tell you, you look around the league already, and for the first couple of days of baseball, Major League Baseball, the league offices have to be loving this, because once again, the ball is flying out of the park, left and right. I mean, there have been these amazingly high-scoring games for early in the year. Usually it takes a little while to settle into a groove. The offenses are everywhere now.
This is very true. I mean, the Mets won on opening day without the long ball.
Yep.
But they had 12 hits and 9 runs, which I found that to be very heartening, that the fact that, and they were getting them with 2 outs. That's something that they hadn't done in the past. I do contribute that to the philosophy of new manager Mickey Callaway, who I like a lot. I very much approved of his hiring, and I like his approach and the way he's doing things. He also kept it down to a relief rotation, if you will, for the first two games. It was the starting pitchers, who were Noah Syndergaard and Jacob deGrom, respectively. Then Robert Gsellman, who had in fact been a starter since 2015, has been moved to the bullpen to be almost a good old-fashioned long man. Then followed by Anthony Swarzak for at least an inning to an inning and a half. He's unfortunately hurting already, which we're already seeing that as well throughout the league. A lot of players going down quickly because I don't think they're just physically ready.
Right.
And then closing it out with Jairus Familiar. It worked on Thursday. It worked yesterday. Yesterday's win was, what was it? I believe it was, what, 6-1?
Mm-hmm.
Or 6-2. Yesterday, the Mets got their first 2 home runs off the bats of Yoenis Cespedes. So that's good that he came through in the second game of the season. And catcher Travis d'Arnaud, who I've not been a big fan or proponent of since his much-heralded arrival. But nevertheless, we're in the baseball season. This is a good thing. It's a good feeling. You know that spring is, in fact, officially here.
Right. Well, and not only that, we're into baseball season. Spring is officially here. And now hockey season is winding in toward its eventual conclusion in the beginning of the playoffs. And hockey had probably its best feel-good story in years this week because of a guy who stepped out of the stands and put on a uniform and played goaltender for the Chicago Blackhawks for about 15 minutes, stopped all 7 shots that he faced. And this guy, I mean, I'm sure there were many, many hockey fans, people who have been to hockey games since they were kids like I have, who have never seen an emergency goalie called into action in a game. And in fact, most of us didn't even know there was such a thing. And here's this guy who's an accountant who, you know, lives and works in Chicago, and he ended up lacing them up for the Blackhawks, and they won the game.
36 years old, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and he's Scott Foster is the guy's name. And he just, you know, he will never buy another beer as long as he lives.
I thought it was a terrific story also. Very happy to see that. Happy for him. And I have heard of emergency goalies. I think one was used in the past with the Rangers. But he was, in fact, at least hockey associated.
Yeah, right.
So there's that. There's one other thing I wanted to bring up on the baseball front, unfortunately, and that is, and if you're a fan of baseball, you will know this name the minute I say it, but he was one of my two boyhood heroes with the New York Mets, a legendary ball player with the Expos, became known to all as Le Grand Orange. Most notably, he was the Mets' solo hero, if you will, in the 1973 playoffs and the World Series. Rusty Staub passed away on opening day on Thursday morning at the age of 74. He'd been in ill health recently, but last Saturday, as a matter of fact, during the final spring game of the season, Keith Hernandez had mentioned that he'd seen Rusty and that he'd, you know, vastly improved and that he seemed to be bouncing back, and you know, it was nothing but a positive report. So hearing this on Thursday morning was just incredibly sad and very painful. And more importantly, if you don't know, Rusty Staub was an incredibly generous, giving man who spent, I would say, the major portion of his post-baseball career working for charities and doing things, especially in the New York area, none more important and greater than the things that he had done in the aftermath of 9/11. But he was so beloved by the people of the city. It doesn't matter if you were a Mets or Yankees fan or a baseball fan. He was so well known to everyone in New York, so loved, and he will genuinely be missed.
Yeah, and you know, a couple of words to put in as well for Jim Kelly, the Buffalo Bills quarterback who was during the 90s. I mean, he was the guy that brought the team respectability for the first time in my lifetime. And he had, you know, again, underwent cancer surgery just over these last couple of days and is in New York City, as a matter of fact, at one of the hospitals there. They haven't said which one because I guess they're trying to protect his privacy. So we will respect that as well. Plus, we just don't know. But he's recovering, and I guess he's still unable to speak. This is the second time that he's had surgery on his jaw area to remove a cancerous tumor. But he says, you know, he's writing on a whiteboard, and I guess he says that everything is going fine, and he's been using Twitter to reach out to the fans and thank everybody for all the well wishes. So, pulling for you, Jim.
I think we all are. So, you know, let's hope there's a positive outcome here.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So, on we go, and there's so much else going on in the world, it's hard to know, again, where to start. So, let's get into a little bit of music, because you've got something up on Pop Dose this week about Erica Blinn. Let's start from start. Who's Erica Blinn?
She is a, I don't like the using, the word is so nebulous to me at this point, especially because I write about so much of this, quote, style of music, but all right. She is what one would consider yet another of the younger pantheon of Americana-oriented musicians. Now, I don't look at her that way, per se. I think of her more in a very young vocally, and I'm saying vocally, a very young Bonnie Raitt style.
Okay.
She's, especially with the, and here's why I don't want to use the word Americana. Her biggest influence is the Jay Giles Band. And, you know, that's a rock band slash blues band, for a start. Working in Nashville, I don't think that equates having to be considered Americana, nor pure country for that matter. But the long and short of it is, she has just released her newest album. It's called Better Than Gold. This is an incredible album. That's the short version of it. It's her second LP. And it has that kind of, oh, and forgive the use of this word as well, that sultriness about it, that when you listen to her voice, plus the get-down groove mode of the music, it's a very sexy album. And I don't mean that in an overtly sexual manner. I mean, it's just an album that when you listen to it, it grabs you. Her voice grabs you. Her voice, like so many singers we've had the good fortune of hearing recently, you know, it, her voice fits the songs.
Come and put your hand in my pocket. Get trust in my offer, please. Why don't you come and see?
first of all, you know, you talked about the rock roots behind this, and it does have a very rootsy kind of feel to it. Not the band The Roots, but that sort of genre of music. But the guys who produced this album, in fact, the Mike Landois, this is a guy who, again, has rock creds all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, Maroon 5 and Blues Traveler, whether you like them or not, I mean, that's one end of the spectrum to the other.
You know, again, it comes through. It's a very full sound, and the song that you've got linked on the page, Softer Side, very cool. So definitely one to check out here. And again, that's the new one from Erica Blinn. It's called Better Than Gold, and the review is up from Rob Ross elsewhere on popdose.com. Anything else going on in the musical world that's really grabbed you over these last little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. There are two things. One that we haven't had the chance to celebrate yet, and that is you may now call him Sir Ringo, or yes. I should say Sir Richard Starkey. Ringo was knighted, and that's a wonderful thing because I dare say all four of them, if John and George were here, deserve it. But Ringo certainly does, and I don't know if you got to see the clip of the actual ceremony, but he was knighted by Prince William, and it was a really, really, it made me smile, it made me feel good because it looked like William was completely excited about knighting one of the Beatles. He just looked like a kid in a candy store. Like they're chatting afterwards. You couldn't hear the dialogue, but you could see the look of excitement in his eyes.
Right.
You're thinking, this is the future King of England. And here's this legend, a living legend right there before him. It was just a magnificent moment. It was a genuine feel-good moment.
And as you said, future King of England, and that may not be all that far off, unfortunately, because there was some news that kind of flew under the radar as everybody was enjoying themselves on Good Friday and, you know, looking forward to, again, as you said, Passover and the weekend's activities around Easter and all of that. But there was some news out of England that Prince Philip made the announcement that they were canceling all of the official events around Easter Sunday. So the Queen wasn't anywhere, and the fact that she wasn't there to do the ceremony with Ringo Starr, she's bailed out of a lot of stuff recently, and they never say anything about her health, but you have to be left to wonder if there may be something going on there they're not saying.
It's interesting also because I would have thought perhaps Prince Charles would have done the investment.
Right.
So, perhaps. But aside from that, there is something else, and this review will actually be up this coming Tuesday on Popdose. And this is obviously this is in our wheelhouse because it's a documentary that it was originally announced around 2011, if I'm not mistaken. And I heard about it by way of my now no longer with us ex-fiance who had posted something on Facebook about her excitement towards this documentary about WLIR Radio.
Yeah.
From Hempstead, Long Island. Now, I'm sure this isn't going to really be grasped or understood by anyone who wasn't within the New York area who could pick up the signal, but the importance of this radio station cannot be understated. WLIR was the first premier commercial, quote, new wave radio station that sustained itself because, and I have to bring in the personal side of it, in around 80 or 81, and I'm sorry, I can't remember exactly, WPIX radio went to a punk new wave format, but it could not withstand. The ratings plunged. WPIX had always been sort of an MOR station and had done fairly well in dentist's office and so on and so forth.
Right.
But when it went to the punk new wave format, it lost revenue, obviously. So it hobbled along for about 2 years. You could say there was almost that smooth transition. As soon as it turned into CD 101.9, all of a sudden WLIR went to the punk new wave format. And ironically, the first time I was able to get 92.7, I was turning the dial and the Jam was on. And that's why it froze me in my tracks because it was the song Circus, which was the Bruce Foxton instrumental from The Gift. And lo and behold, there's this radio station playing The Jam and The Psychedelic Furs and The Cure and Translator. This is around, I want to say, October of 1982, very early October of 82. And there it was, you know, and I was hooked. And the things I heard just added to my weekly shopping list of every Saturday going into the city to buy records.
Yeah.
And WLIR's call was "Dare to be different." That was their war cry.
Oh, back when radio still would, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, growing up in New York as you did, you were used to this to some degree, and being on the other side of the state in Buffalo for a while and then in Tampa, those are still two pretty good radio markets, but they're not New York. They're not New York by a long shot. And that idea of having somebody actually break ground formatically, I mean, invent a new format, is something that doesn't happen outside of New York and LA, and now it doesn't happen anywhere. But even back then, it was something that the rest of the country had to have sort of accumulate popularity and distribute itself to us.
Well, the thing is, they took that format, even though it had already been tested, but they kept it.
Right.
And they stayed true to it. And the most important thing about WLIR is the fact that, and I can say this without question, without WLIR's presence at that time, you're talking about 82, 83, 84, which was, I think, the absolute apex. MTV would not have gained the traction that it did by virtue of those early videos that they used to show,
right,
with things like A Flock of Seagulls or Ultravox or Adam and the Ants and all the stuff from England that you wouldn't find anywhere else.
Because they didn't have to pay for them. That's why MTV was running that stuff, is it was free.
And also with the fact that these bands, and we have to keep in mind that this was also during the, I would say, the infancy to toddler period of college radio really adopting the quote punk, new wave, and alternative formats.
Right.
You know, or at least being the champions of that genre. WLIR, you know, you have to remember, and this is something that people forget, none of these were independent bands by any stretch of the imagination. They were all very low tier to the record executives on major labels here. You know,
yeah, they were all signed, right.
Duran Duran was on the Capitol imprint Harvest, for God's sakes. You know, Adam and the Ants were on Epic. A Flock of Seagulls were on Jive. Bauhaus was on, at that point, A&M. Beggar's Banquet had various distribution deals, et cetera, et cetera. And WLIR played these bands and broke them in the States. And they had a very clever way of doing things. First of all, they were not – I don't want to use the word freeform because we're not talking about freeform on the station itself. But the people who worked at the station had that sort of, I guess, easy come, easy go attitude. But one of the main things that they stuck with was when they knew that new records were coming in from England, they would send a couple of people from the station out to the airport to get them before they even got to record stores. There were a couple of records that were recorded and released, let's say – it was technically released on October 24th. It was in the hands of WLIR maybe 48 to 72 hours later.
Yeah, see, and what we had to do is we had to wait for a few weeks to go by before somebody in New York called a buddy of theirs in whatever town we were living in at the time, told him about it, and the only time we would hear it is when a guy walked in at 2 o'clock in the morning to do the 2 to 5 a.m. shift, and they weren't listening to him anyway, and he could say, "Hey, a buddy of mine just laid this Ian Dury and the Blockheads record on me." And that's how we got that stuff. You know, we wouldn't have known about it if it hadn't been for that.
Well, the great thing about WLIR is the fact that it also – first of all, if you think about it, they're there in Hempstead, Long Island.
Right.
And they managed to inspire and spurn on a complete scene by virtue of the people that listened. And it was a rabid fan base.
Right.
Now, I'm here in Staten Island and I got the signal, albeit not great, and I listened with religiosity behind it. It also enabled clubs out there to open up, like Spit and Levittown, which I went to, my father's place, which was already there, and they kind of changed their direction from being a typical rock-styled bar to a new wave bar. And Malibu, you know, they were all out there in Long Island. So suddenly, you did have a very serious stronghold of this – although I will say it was the more British-inspired new wave or immediate post-new wave stuff, because at the time, you know, I remember WLIR, for instance, would play the 4 o'clock interviews, and you know, on Tuesday Pete Buck was being interviewed, and on Wednesday Paul Weller.
Yeah,
you know,
not bad.
Set format or anything like that. There was also the Sunday night concert series. The Jam were on there, REM were on there, the Style Council were on there, and then there was Off the Boat, which was the weekly brand new imports program. And there are a whole bunch of things that I remember hearing on that show that never subsequently got released here, but they're in my collection because I got the import singles, because I heard them. First and foremost, I will never forget, and I'm always going to be grateful to them for playing it, was the band Time UK, who very few to no people know or remember. That was the band that was formed by Rick Buckler after the Jam's breakup. Yeah. He was the first one in the immediate aftermath of their split to go on to another project and have something out on the market. And they played on the show one particular Sunday a song called Playground of Privilege. And I thought it was a great song and I bought it. And it's funny because it was also on Arista and it was produced by Tony Visconti. And I got the single and the B-side was what floored me, a song called Puppets Don't Bleed. So, you know, it was that show that did so much, that station that did so much for so many of us over the years. So now you have this documentary, which is on Showtime right now. It's being screened at various points of the week, and it's also on Showtime On Demand. And it has people like Joan Jett, Billy Idol, Nick Rhodes, Mike Score from A Flock of Seagulls, Mike Peters of The Alarm, Cyril Kernan from The Fix. It has a whole host of the DJs, a lot of the fans, some of the club owners, some of the record company people, some of the booking agents. It's really, really well done, and I completely and freely admit that in watching it, it brought back a tidal wave of memories and emotions.
Yeah.
That, you know, yes, I remember the when and where.
And part of that, I think, is something that you edged into and didn't quite get there, which is because it's so ingrained in us. I mean, it's second nature to us, so we don't think of it as a thing. But going out and seeking out music and having to go out of your way to try to find something, having to order something, having to have something come in, you know, that you had to wait weeks for, the idea of doing that, I mean, there is no effort involved anymore. Anything you want, literally anything you want, you can have on your computer in seconds. And it's a different world. It doesn't make you work as hard to find something truly special.
Well, we talked about that when we talked about the fact that things like toy stores are going away and children not having the experience.
Right, right.
And the joy.
And there's news there too.
Yeah. The thing is, though, with this period, you know, right up until I found LIR, our whole means was always, well, it was twofold. It was, we listened to Scott Muni on WNEW-FM because he had a show called Things from England on Fridays at 4 o'clock, and WNEW being the rock station. This was the gold standard. So he'd play stuff and we would go the next day, Saturday. You know, for a lot of kids, Sunday you go to church or Sunday school. Jewish kids go to, you know, they either go to temple for the Sabbath or they go to Hebrew school. We would all meet up at the ferry, go up and hit as many record stores as we could.
Right.
Knowing that those stores were going to have some of these things that we may have heard the day before. And that was our means. And while we were in the record stores, we would pick up the physical press. New Musical Express, Melody Maker, Sounds, whatever was there. That was how we did it. Or, you know, if we heard something that might be cool by word of mouth, like, you're going to love this band, they're called The Teardrop Explodes. You know, and then all of a sudden you might hear it on WSIA, who was in its infancy. That was the local college radio station. You would do it that way. WLIR was a means of access that we hadn't had before because it was so much broader. You know, and plus there was just so much more of it, and it wasn't constricted in terms of this show is the new wave punk show, like college radio. You had the one student DJ playing prog rock, the one playing avant music, or, you know, things like Stockhausen and so on and so forth. This was 24/7 punk and new wave, period.
Yeah.
And it was a driving force for all of us. And it's a wonderful documentary. It's really enjoyable. It's also one of those, I'm happy to say, complete documentaries. It's linear. It tells the story from start to finish because it doesn't go any further than when WLIR had to cease and desist in 1987. It doesn't talk about how it not long after became WDRE, which carried on for several more years. And, you know, it was much more alternative-based, and I use that term with contempt. You know, I personally stopped listening to LIR around December of 85 because I had found WHTG, which was quite different. It was from Eatontown, New Jersey. I would love to see a documentary made on that station because they were a commercial station. The signal obviously was much stronger since Eatontown is about 45 minutes to an hour away from me. And their thing was more of the it was more of a freeform radio where you would hear, because I did hear this, you would hear Killing Joke, Creedence, That Petrol Emotion, and Cream in the same four songs, because it happened in the car during the summer of 87. You know, hearing Fire Dances going into Looking Out My Back Door in the Swamp into I Feel Free is just amazing, you know? And so HTG became the guiding force. I found HTG when we were fiddling with the dial one night while in a state of inebriation, and Reoccurring Dreams by Husker Du came on. All 15 minutes of it. Now, any station that plays something like that, you're going to stay tuned to.
Yeah, that's excellent. I can't wait to see it. I honestly can't. And LIR, I know by reputation only, and still, I can't wait to see this documentary. That's going to be a hell of a good time.
You really will very much enjoy it. I think you'll be moved by it. Yeah. I think you'll find that, you know, even though you may not have listened to WLIR, you're going to be, you know, wrapped up in the memories of that period because it is a period piece, so to speak, because you're going to start thinking about when you heard, it's like when you heard REM for the first time. It's one of those kinds of films that it was really enjoyable. And it made me a little weepy because, of course, remembering the time, and also because Susan's not here to actually see the completed film. So that's the other end of the spectrum for me. So it was very much well worth my time. And I do want to say this much. Speaking of film, I did sit last night and I watched The Last Jedi.
Oh, okay.
And I did not dislike it as much as I believed I was going to. It was a little extraneously clunky, and there were some very unnecessary bits that they could have easily done without.
Yeah.
I thought that the alleged subplots that people were up in arms about were non-existent as far as I could see. And the one big – there are one argument, one beef I have. The argument that they turned Luke Skywalker into a dislikable coward. Did anybody listen to anything he said?
No. No, they didn't. If that's the message they came away with, then no, they didn't.
No. He came off as being disillusioned, knowing what he had done, and that's why he had left. And it wasn't a coward's thing to do. It was, I've done a grand injustice.
Right.
But here's why I did it, you know. And certainly they gave him a sense of humor at the end, when, especially with the scene when – because this is not a spoiler alert now that it's everywhere. When Ben Solo says, you know, fire every weapon at him, and, you know, they finish firing and it looks like he's just a grease spot. And then, the smoke clears. He stands there and he brushes off his shoulder.
Right.
And then Ben Solo makes that speech about destroying everything, and he's like, you're wrong. You know, I will not be the last Jedi. On the contrary, the war has just begun. And if you – and I, you know, there was a point where I was actually doing the lines from Revenge of the Jedi because so many of them were used. You know, talk about cheap retreading.
Yeah. And thank you for calling it by its correct name, by the way.
You better believe it. When he says, if you strike me down with all your hate, I'll be with you all the time, just like your father. See you around, kid.
Right.
I thought that was a great drop. I really got pissed when Snoke started making Emperor Ovaltine's speech, you know, the hate. You know, and I'm sitting there going, strike me down with all your hate and anger, and your journey to the dark side will be complete.
Yeah.
Then my young Skywalker suffer for your lack of vision. You will die. You know, that's what I'm waiting for. The other problem I had was when Luke, much like Yoda, just disappears.
Yep.
Carrie Fisher had been dead already a year by the time of the movie's release. I think it would have made much more sense in the symbiotic relationship between Luke and Leia that once she felt his departure, if you will, she could go too. What are you going to do in the next movie, for God's sakes?
Well, you know, the way they were setting it up is that the first one was Han Solo's portion of the next generation of stories. This one was Luke Skywalker's story of the next generation. And the next one was supposed to be Leia, which puts them in a really interesting position. Do they recast that role, or do they just go off in an entirely different direction? And the one name that has been floated in this, it's nothing more than internet rumors, but they're out there, is Meryl fucking Streep. Oh, please, just find a lightsaber and chop my head off with it now.
No, let's just say no and leave it at that. The other thing is, and I'm going to say that, and I'm going to go on a limb, and I'm sure others have said it, but I will say it right now. That whole thing about Ben Solo saying to Rey, you know, that your parents were nobody. They were just a couple of drunkards who sold you. No.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, the problem I had with this dialogue, you know, Poe saying things like, and this big ass cannon and what the hell. First of all, throughout the entire, and I mean the entire, even the prequels, the entire Star Wars film series, no one has ever used any profanity at any time.
Right, not even close.
And that took us right out of the story, and it pissed us both off.
Yep.
And I think justifiably so. But I think that was a complete ruse with him saying that your parents were nobodies. Nobody alcoholics, quote-unquote, are Jedis. It just doesn't happen,
right.
Okay? She's a Skywalker. So it's going to come down to one of two things. Either it will be established that she is indeed Rey Skywalker, daughter of Luke, or that she is in fact Rey Skywalker Solo, daughter of Han and Leia, which would make them twins, which is why they have that interlocking connection, because the dynamic between them is very curious. It's a two-way street. It's one of obvious psychic and emotional connectivity, because he became human again because of her.
Right.
There's also a very weirdly psychosexual dynamic there with the two of them too. Unfortunately, like Luke and Leia in the first one. But remember, brothers and sisters don't fuck. So you can't have that. I didn't see it coming. I didn't even know that it happened, that it was in fact Ben who smited down Snoke and saved Rey. I thought that was a magnificent moment, and I think that's where it showed that, yep, he's still human. Now the question is he out for complete and utter control of everything because he's evil, or is he out for complete and utter control of everything so he can unite it once and for all? That's the question, but it's not a naive one, simply because in order to sell tickets and sell the story of good versus bad, it's because he wants complete control, and Rey's going to have to stop him. And if they go into the, quote, Star Wars universe, like the book version where the Solo kids, who are twins, one is bad, the other one is good, it's kind of Cain and Abel, you know, the killing of your
right.
own sibling.
Yep.
We shall see. But I did not hate it.
No.
So I'm glad I didn't hate it.
Right, and I'm ready to hate the next one. I'm ready to hate Solo, but we'll see. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
Because I'm just not going to go see it. You know, it's not a Star Wars movie per se. I don't need another, because to me that's like a prequel.
Right.
I don't need this.
Right, yeah, another origin story. Yeehaw.
Exactly, I don't need it.
Now, on, you mentioned in passing the death of Toys R Us, you know, with the radio stations and everything else, and the death of Toys R Us has caused something fairly interesting to happen. It's not really a full-fledged resuscitation of another long-dead toy store name, but there was an announcement made when Toys R Us gave up the ghost and said, okay, we're selling off all of our remaining stock, and that's it. We're going to pay off as many creditors as we can, and good night, everybody. We're out of here. That all of a sudden another name announced that they were going to rebrand themselves and start doing these pop-up locations of toy stores that will be sort of event-based. And it's been a long time. I'm interested to see how this works, just because the name KB Toys, even when it was still around but in its death throes, was never a name that grabbed us and said, you know, we ought to go over to KB Toys. It was more like, oh, yeah. There's the scuzzy little toy store in the mall. I wonder if there's anything interesting in there.
You just hit it right out of the park because it was a mall store. And it was like so many other mall franchises, whether it was KB or Lane Bryant or Ann Taylor or, you know, Music Land or Paperback Booksmith. You know, it was
Walden Books.
Walden Books. You know, it was in the mall. It was the second floor of the Staten Island Mall, right above the section of the mall where I worked in the record store, because I worked directly across from the Gap, and Prince Plus was to our immediate right if you were standing facing out towards the mall. But look, at least it's a form, A, of resurrection for a name brand, if you will, and B, it can at least, and I may be spitballing here, but it can at least lead to at least some children having an experience that they otherwise wouldn't have.
And they don't know enough. They don't. The kids who could conceivably be given that experience through this, they don't know from the old KB toys. They don't have anything negative to associate it with, like you and I do. So, you know, it's a clean slate for them.
Right. I mean, for, you know, for us, you know, because when we were growing up, when we were teenagers and in our early 20s, you know, the mall epitomized one thing, the youth culture center.
Right.
And that was it. You know, there was, it was either, that was where the youth, you know, congregated, or it was a giant pickup place.
Yeah.
You know, because that's where you always went to score. I mean, working in a record store made you a stud automatically.
And once again, with all due respect to Roger Klein, I will point out that maybe I was never cool enough to get a job at a record store, but, you know.
See, the beauty of it was, and I didn't realize this until I was about 50, is that by not knowing that I was cool made me cool.
Yeah.
Being unaware is what keeps you safe.
Right. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see if this works out. And, you know, when you start talking about those other names of long dead, long deceased businesses, I was amazed. When I was a kid, our family business was a pizza restaurant. And in fact, it was a series of them before I was born. By the time I came around, there were only two left. And the one that was there the longest lived into the late 80s or early 90s and finally gave up the ghost. But that was that was it. That was what built our family fortune and allowed my grandfather to retire in Honolulu. And there are worse things in this world. So when I decided to put up a bunch of old pictures and build a Facebook page dedicated to that restaurant and what my memories of it were, I was amazed at how many people from my hometown were all over it talking about, oh, I miss this place and I would love to go back there and have another pizza after the high school football game on Friday nights. And it's a very powerful thing because all I knew was that was the building I effectively grew up in. You know, I didn't know that there was this great nostalgia and this great love for it. But, you know, even the bigger names, I would love to be able to walk into a Woolworths again. Just, you know, because I remember it. I remember being a kid and walking into that place and seeing guys who were on their lunch break eating lunch at the counter and all of that stuff. I remember what it smelled like in there.
You know, 50 cents for a grilled cheese sandwich. Well, I'll tell you something.
Yep.
Your family would have made a killing. I mean, if you think Honolulu is good, your grandfather could have bought an island. If he had a pizzeria, a pizza restaurant where people congregated on Staten Island, you want to talk about, you know, memories of a place and
right.
nostalgia. You look at any of the Staten Island memories pages, and they'll bring up places that, whether it was 50 years ago or 20 years ago, there's like a lineage of people who remember these things, you know? Like, I'll give you a perfect example. There was a place that we used to go to called Pizza Town, and it looked like a Big Top. You know, it had one of those really funny – it was a circular building, and it had like the roof of a Big Top.
Uh-huh.
You know? It was painted red, white, and blue, and it had a big clown outside. You know, and great pizza, amazing calzones. Was there from the time that we moved to the island, and we moved in on New Year's Eve 1967 till about – and it was there, you know. And then around 1990 or so, it just suddenly closed. But the memories and the nostalgia and the things that people say, or Danino's, very much a family place, small, you know, can hold maybe a few hundred people. They only serve like maybe four or five types of pizza.
Yeah.
And over the years, they are the quote-unquote cornerstone of Staten Island pizza. They are Staten Island's best pizza, first of all. They opened up a shop in New Jersey, and they recently, I would say maybe late last summer, opened up on the corner of Bleecker and McDougal, of all things. That's how long, but when you say Danino's in Staten Island, the reverence, you know, that's the thing, the reverence. Yeah. And it's a family restaurant. In fact, there was an article on Friday morning in the Staten Island Advance about after 80 years, Danino's is going stronger than ever. So that when you talk about things like that, it's also because we're from you're not from Buffalo per se. You're not from like the center of the city.
No,
correct?
from Kenmore, which is just north of the northernmost boundary of the city.
Right. When you're from a smaller pocket, like I'm from the suburbs of New York City.
Uh-huh.
We get to experience those kind as we get older, come away with those kinds of memories.
Yeah.
People around us do too.
It's funny because there was something that happened, I guess, in one of the New York newspapers. It was not the Times because I would remember that one, but somebody did one of these articles about Western New York. And I guess they had gone to some kind of food fair in Buffalo or something like that. And they were talking about the beef on Weck and the chicken wings and all of that stuff. And they said, and you can get a garbage plate, which is a staple for people at 2 o'clock in the morning. And everybody in Buffalo was going, what? What the hell's a garbage plate? Turns out that's a Rochester thing. Rochester's about 90 miles away from Buffalo toward the city. And nobody in Buffalo has ever heard of this. And, you know, I know it's a small thing, but if you're going to do an article for a New York publication, a New York City publication, and you can't even fact check what food comes from where, don't write the article.
Exactly, because I've heard of garbage plates. I saw it on Man vs. Food.
Okay, yeah.
And where Adam Richman was, I think, was in Syracuse, actually.
Which is even farther in toward the city, yeah.
Or just, you know, on the road between Rochester and Syracuse. But I think it was a Syracuse geared show because he never stayed exactly in the city limits itself,
yeah,
on every episode. Nevertheless, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, Staten Island has its certain pizzas and its certain, you know, things here. And, you know, one of the things that we can say with great pride is we're one of the places that has the original Italian ices.
Yeah.
Ralph's actually in its original location is right across the street from Danino's and has been there longer than Danino's has existed.
Yeah.
And the thing is, on a summer day, you go to Danino's, you have lunch, and you go across to Ralph's, you wait online, you just be patient, wait online, and you get your choices of water ices, cream ices, mixed. You take your choices, but that's a Staten Island thing. And if you dare say anything about Brooklyn influence, you're going to find yourself probably missing a lot of teeth.
Right.
If you're wearing cement shoes, now, and justifiably so.
The one thing that Rochester did come up with, and we will give them credit where it's due, that did make its way down the I-90 into Buffalo, there's a thing called a Rochester White Hot, and it's akin to a hot dog, but instead of beef being the main meat in it, it's mostly pork. So they're white. It kind of looks a little bit like a stadium brat, but it doesn't taste the same. It's much more of a hot dog kind of consistency. And Rochester White Hots are outstanding. But yeah, those you can get in Buffalo.
You know, speaking of pork, for Easter dinner, if you will, yeah, or whatever you want to call it, my wife made the most outstanding, and that's why I want to give her a quick shout out, the most outstanding meatballs. She made it with pork, veal, and a little bit of beef. And it was just – they were so good and so tasty.
Yeah.
You know, they've got so much flavor to them. I mean, she's got no Italian in her.
Yeah.
But see, that's the beauty of, you know, being from New York City, and especially if you live in Staten Island. Now, she grew up in Manhattan. She's not a Staten Islander by birth or by rearing. You know, she moved here when we met and married. But – first of all, she's a great cook, and second of all, there's just this certain thing. You know, it's also the fact that from where we're from, we sort of know, because we're natives of it, the how and where and when to make certain things. It's just there intrinsically in us.
Yeah.
You know, and that's I think, part of the beauty of it. So, you know, well, question. Actually, answer this for me, just so I know for my own, In case I ever get mired in an argument, what is the proper cheese? Is it blue cheese or is it supposed to be ranch dressing for
Chicken wings? Blue cheese dressing, period.
It is blue cheese, I thought so.
Yeah. Ranch dressing isn't even real. That doesn't even exist. That was an invention of Hidden Valley, and it just, I don't know what that stuff is, but yeah.
If you're from New York, it's kind of like if you're from New York, you don't put mustard on your burgers.
Right. Yeah, I'm right there with you. It's ketchup on a hamburger. Now, there are a couple of other things that we wanted to get into. And by the way, last week we ended up in our head segment with one of your songs, with Train of Thought. And it's odd that there's a connection back to that again, because one of the other stories that was big in the news in New York this week was that the MTA is jacking up the fares again. What's going on?
This whole, we need to be able to pay for, I don't want to hear it beyond those words. I don't want to hear the words MTA fare hike. And this is something that is squarely on the shoulders of both Cuomo and de Blasio. Pure and simple. For years and years and years, the MTA, which is one of the most atrocious systems on the planet, has done this, and I'm sure you remember when there was suddenly this very, very nebulous period where they found that, wait a minute, your books don't match your budget. There's a surplus of money. And there was a big hue and cry about, okay, we want to roll back on the fares.
Uh-huh.
And it never materialized. And now they're talking about raising fares again. You know what? I don't care that you need to, quote, rebuild the tunnel that leads the L train into Williamsburg. I don't want to hear about a fare hike. I don't want to hear it because, as I've gone through for the last 3 months, almost every night, like clockwork, and for some reason it always seems to happen just after 6 o'clock, and I know it happens on other lines because the F train is one of the worst lines on the planet. The G train is probably the slowest on the planet. But every night at around just after 6, if I'm taking the R or the W back down to Whitehall Street, there's always some kind of nonsense where, ladies and gentlemen, because of a red signal ahead, we are being held in the station. We apologize for any inconvenience. And you sit there for a year and a day.
Yep.
Okay? I don't want to hear it. And I get really infuriated when they say, there's a W train in front of us and it's on the R track. No, the W splits when it goes into the Whitehall Street station. They always do this around Rector Street. As soon as the train moves – no. The W train goes right in the middle. The R train is on the right. There's no W in front of you at Whitehall Street. It's this kind of nonsense that happens over and over and over again, and it drives me crazy. I've actually tweeted some very, very angry anti-MTA tweets because, they get very umpy about mean tweets because, they're kind of precious at the MTA.
Yeah, well.
And it's ironic that who they brought back to be the chairman of the MTA is the moron who ran against the other moron who just became mayor, Joe Loda, who ran against Bill de Blasio. He's back in as the chairman of the MTA. And suddenly under his stewardship, now they want to raise prices again. And that includes things like the Long Island Railroad, which people can barely afford, and Metro North, which people seem to always die on because those trains are the most dangerous in a public transport system.
Right.
They always derail. There are always these horrific accidents, and deaths always seem to be the result. So, I'm not happy about this, not in the least.
No, I hear you. And I mean, when you've got a system like that where they can't get their shit together and now they're asking for more money, and you know that even if they get more money, which they probably will, they're still not going to get their shit together. It's a little more than frustrating.
To explain to me why you had to spend millions of dollars on these, countdown clocks, as they call them, in the station. Why didn't you put that money towards refurbishing the stations?
Right.
We don't need a countdown clock. We know that a train comes every few minutes. I don't need to know the imprecision of what you think the time will be when the train arrives.
Exactly. And
that to me was infuriating. And I do mean infuriating. Those clocks don't work either. When things go awry in the system, all you see is the date and time. You don't see any destinations or login name. It doesn't show that there's a certain name that they use for the trains. I guess it's designations, but there are no line designations shown. It's just date and time, and that tells me you pissed our money away.
Right. Right, exactly. So now you want more money? No, it doesn't work like that. Make it the old-fashioned way. Earn it. So we've got a few things to get into. Before we get into the politics this week, there was one thing that you noticed, and I saw it when it happened as well, and it's one of those things you just see and you go, yep, which is the death of the last northern white rhino. We're in the middle of a major, major extinction phase. And we're seeing animals just disappear from the planet left and right. And we don't notice it, unfortunately, until it's something we remember seeing in the zoo when we were kids. But this goes back 100 years, and now it's culminating in seeing some of these huge creatures that when you see the very last one and it's so decrepit and so old that it can barely move and they have to stick a needle in it and kill it, there's a little bit of something that just leaves your breath, you know, when you just, oh, there's nothing else you can do because we haven't the first foggiest idea what the fuck to do about any of it.
Well, the thing that leaves me is just a sense of disillusionment in people in general, because a lot of it is unnecessary. A lot of these extinctions are unnecessary, you know, because there are hunters and poachers.
Right.
You know, I'm not an arbiter of it. I hate it. I don't see the necessity. Unless you're killing something like deer because you need to feed your family, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear excuses, you know, whether it's elephants, jaguars, you know, lions, tigers, bears. I don't want to hear it.
And what do they all have in common? And this is the worst part of it by far to me, is whether it's shark finning or the jaguars that you mentioned or the rhinos or the elephant ivory. Why are they being killed?
Money.
Money because, and it's even worse than that, because you follow that money down the line. The reason why rhino horn gets $17 million a gram or whatever the hell it is, and the same thing with elephant ivory and the same thing with shark fin soup and all of that stuff, is because some idiot somewhere thinks if he eats enough of it, his dick will get harder.
And that's why they fire a gun, too.
Right. Well, but literally, I mean, that's where this stuff comes from, is this pseudoscientific belief that, you know, these things are aphrodisiacs. And, you know, if you eat rhino horn, it'll make your dick look like a rhino horn. And that's honest to God the reason why this stuff happened. The reason why there are no more white male white rhinos in the world is because they were killed off because somebody thought it might make their dick bigger.
So does killing a really beautiful jaguar or a leopard make your dick bigger? Or is it just the psychosomatic ideal because keep big hunter has gun?
That's part of it. But yeah, there is it's the teeth. They wear the teeth around their necks as a necklace, and it's supposed to be a talisman that makes your dick hard.
Jesus.
Yeah, I know. It's a psychosis that is so completely unbelievable, and yet we're wiping animals off the planet for it. So isn't that great? You know, Viagra exists, guys. You can stop killing off all the rhinos.
No kidding. And that, to me, makes me want to make people more extinct. That's why it goes right back to my theory. Why you should vote for me as your malevolent dictator.
Yep.
I promise you. It's not a case of wanting to wipe out the Second Amendment and take away your guns. I want to stop hunters from killing animals.
Right.
I want to feed the hunters to the animals. I want the hunters to become the hunted. I want to see a pride of lions tear some motherfucker apart, just like they did the other day when a hunter, and I'm using the word in quotation marks, killed a cub.
Right.
Good.
Yeah, and it's always the same kind of guys. I mean, who is it that goes off and cuts the tail off of an elephant so he can show it in his selfie? Well, it's Donald Trump Jr. and Eric. And who is it that goes and kills the male lion that everybody in the village loved? It's some shithead dentist from Minneapolis who, as soon as they interview him, you know he is the biggest asshole on the planet. He's the Martin Shkreli of dentists.
And he's quaking in his boots. He's like, I'm scared. Well, good. You should be scared.
Yeah, right.
Piece of shit.
Yeah, how do you think the lion felt, asshole?
You know, I can honestly hope that there will be justice meted out. You know, really good karmic justice.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, speaking of Martin Shkreli, did you hear about the Wu-Tang album?
Not lately. No.
Okay, Martin Shkreli. This is the pharma bro that everybody wants.
I know what he did as far as, you know, paying the what was it, like $50 million for the unreleased Wu-Tang album.
Right. They only made one copy of this album. It's called Once Upon a Time in Shaolin. And it's the only copy of this album in existence. And they put it up for auction. And he was the one who had the money, so he bought it. Well, he had to forfeit that this week because he was fined $7 million and has to go to prison for fraud. And as part of the settlement, he had to give up anything that he gained with the money that he got from the fraud. And part of that paid for the Wu-Tang album. So now... And this may be the only worthwhile, entertaining thing that's happened out of the Trump administration. Because right now, the world's only copy of Once Upon a Time in Shaolin by Wu-Tang Clan is in the hands of Jeff Sessions. Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III. Long time, well-known Wu-Tang fan. well, he may be a fan of the Clan, but it's probably not the same one. So
let me just tell you something. That is a big old shout-out to those of us here who represent Shaolin.
Yes, sir.
West, yo.
So, yeah, I don't know what happens now.
Oh, that's priceless. No pun intended, but I mean, seriously, that's great. Oh, I love it. I mean, shout out to Wu-Tang.
That's right. And by the way, the guy, I want to say he's on the CBS Early Show, who sits there every morning. The new guy that's on the CBS Early Show sits there every morning with his laptop open, and there's a Wu-Tang sticker on the back of his laptop. So,
John Heilman.
Oh, is that who it is? Okay, yeah.
John Heilman, who's he's also the co-host of The Circus with his now fallen partner. And I say fallen because, he touched a woman inappropriately, apparently. Mark Halperin.
Right.
The Circus on Showtime. And, of course, John Heilman, who is a regular contributor to Morning Joe.
Yeah, I love it. Every time I see that laptop, I think, somebody's listening to something I wouldn't expect them to.
Heilman actually is really like that, whereas I forgot what's his name used to listen to, Halperin. I mean, they were my favorites.
Yeah.
Far and away, when it came to especially during the political campaigns. And you and I talked about this, but of course, the most salient moment was the night of the election itself, and they were on live with Stephen Colbert on the live Showtime Late Night with Stephen Colbert.
Right.
And they were drinking on the air when the word came down on the wire that Trump had, in effect, won the election.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it got quiet and nobody knew what to say as Colbert refilled their glasses. And then he said, "What is your feeling on this?" And Halpern, without a sense of irony or smile or anything, looked right at Colbert and said, "Along with 9/11 and Pearl Harbor,
yeah,
this may be the most catastrophic event in American history."
There you go. And he wasn't wrong.
It's not on the air now, huh?
Right. Yeah. Well, and now you look around and what's happened. I mean, you look even this week, the big fight. And there have been two people who have stepped right into the fray on this. And we talked a little bit last week about the aftermath of the Florida shootings in Parkland and the fact that, now as a right winger and a gun nut, you have a choice. You can ignore them or you can step in and attack a bunch of 17-year-old kids that the entire world has already decided we like. And joining the attack this week were, no great surprise, Mr. Wango Tango, his own self, who described a bunch of 17-year-old kids as pathetic, to which I'm sure they responded, "Who the fuck is Ted Nugent? why does he think he's relevant in this?"
Yeah.
That's response. Well, and the other one was Laura Ingrown, the foghorn voiced commentator for Fox News, and she's got her own radio show. And why this woman draws breath, I have no idea. But she also stepped in and engaged in a Twitter battle with one of these kids. And it's so senseless. And now her advertisers are leaving in droves and the kids are saying, "Yeah, well, she apologized. Big deal. She apologized because money's flying out of her pocket," which shows you that at 17 years old, they know way more about the way the world works than we did when we were 17 years old.
Which is kind of a sad statement. And I was having this conversation the other day simply because young people now are old.
Yes. Yeah. It's like, don't snow me.
Children aren't children anymore. I look at little children and they look like midgets.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that in a funny way. They all look like they're little old people.
Right.
They don't sound like children. You know, when you and I were growing up, we were wearing Hang Ten and health techs.
Yeah, and it's, you know, there's a wisdom about them that it's unfortunate that they have to have.
Right. So teenagers now are just far and away much more hardened and cynical. Look, when we were kids, we went from being kids to teenagers to miserable, and that was it.
Yeah.
Now there's tweeners.
Well, and it was pointed out to me that there was one of these, the first one, some nobody who's like a senator in Maine or something like that, that is one of those states nobody ever goes to. And he was the first one. And a couple of days after the shootings happened, he picked on Emma Gonzalez and said he called her a skinhead lesbian or something like that. And a buddy of mine pointed out to me, he said, you know, to kids who are 17, 18, 19, 20, even 25, and even close to 30 years old now, referring to somebody as a lesbian as a pejorative doesn't mean anything to them. They're like, yeah, she's a lesbian. Okay, yeah, and her eyes are blue and she's got hair. And, you know, it's like, who cares?
It's like Cynthia Nixon is an unqualified lesbian.
It's not an insult anymore.
Right. She's an unqualified asshole.
Right.
And she should shut her fucking mouth is what she should do and go away now.
Right. But
she makes herself into a complete laughingstock. But that's the whole thing. We're living in a time where you get to a point where everything is so oversaturated that, it goes back to, remember what we talked about when Dick Gregory died and, the book.
Right.
And I'm going to use the name of the book because we're talking about the title of the book, Nigger. I remember when Lenny Bruce made a kind of joke about that. You know, he said, people talk about words. And this is obviously long before Carlin ever did the famous Seven Dirty Words bit. He said, people talk about words and consider them dirty. You know, when you stand there and call a little black child nigger, 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 you scream it to a point where it doesn't have any meaning anymore.
Yep.
You want to talk about dirty? Hiroshima was dirty.
Yeah.
That's the Lenny Bruce line. And we are reaching that point of oversaturation with phrases and names and classifications. You know what? How many times in my lifetime have I been called kike?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. I so many names, I can't even count them all. And it still happens.
Somebody would call me kike, don't you? Because I'm a Jew.
Yeah, right.
And that's kind of, it goes with the territory. But your point is what? And I am, so what?
Exactly. You're right. I mean, calling somebody a lesbian right now is the same as saying, you know, she's got arms. Well, yeah, and so? Of course she does. You know, it's like, who gives a shit? And that's the funny thing is that they don't see it that way. It's not even so much that they get upset that you use that as an insult. They don't even get that it's an insult, which is great. So maybe the generation in between that was so focused on every word and what do you mean by that? And you can't say that. And maybe that's starting to go away. And maybe these 17, 18, 19 year old kids realize it doesn't mean anything. And we can talk about things that are actually important and how actions mean more than the words you use to describe them. They seem smart enough to get that. I'm hoping I'm right.
Well, I mean, I don't put much stock in young people as it is right now because young people have the attention span overall of a gnat.
Yeah.
So that's my collective contempt for young people. But look, when we were kids, you know, they were fighting the younger generation was fighting against the old guard about Vietnam and so. But that was another tangible fight. You're sending young men to die overseas for what again?
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
When we were teenagers, what were we bitching about, you know, getting the last can of hair mousse, I guess, at CVS?
Well, yeah, but with John Bolton where he is right now, that idea of sending young people off somewhere else to die is not all that far-fetched an idea.
Right. That's and as we talked about last week, that does not make me feel very good. You know, we joke about what's his name, the fat prick who's the president right now, but this is a different kettle of fish because this guy's a professional warmonger.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't exactly care for him. So, you know, I think I'll leave it at that. By the way, we have breaking news right now. For those of you who are fans of something like Hill Street Blues or Cop Rock, Stephen Bochco has died at the age of 74.
No, wow. so much great TV. So much great TV that had Stephen Butchko. So much lousy TV that had Butchko's name on it, too. You mentioned Cop Rock.
Exactly.
But, yeah.
If you're a total cornball and you like bands like Toto, then naturally, you know, you like Cop Rock.
Well, you know what? In his honor, let's stay with that then, because I was considering this anyway when we were talking about TV, of going into the In Our Heads segment with something that's akin to that, because Hill Street Blues was one of, oh Lord, I don't know how many, of that era, from probably 1981 all the way through to 1986 or 87, of television shows that came out and had songs, because, I mean, TV shows don't have theme songs anymore. They have a little bit of music at the front, and it's all because they want to squeeze in 30 seconds worth of more commercials. So when TV shows still had theme songs, long theme songs, there were some of them that actually charted. Hill Street Blues was one of them. Hill Street Blues actually had a pretty good run on the top 40 charts and would play. They would just play it on the radio, you know, top 40 station. Here's the Hill Street Blues theme. A little bit about those, because I have my list of favorites when it comes to TV theme songs, and not all of them charted, but everybody I think has them, and they bring back not only the memories of the shows themselves, but just there's something about those pieces of music that are just fantastic when you have 30 seconds to get in and get out. So what are the ones that stick with you? What do you like?
What do you think would be my number one? It's kind of obvious.
Here we come. Walk down the street, we get the funniest looks from everyone we meet. Hey, hey, we're the monkeys, and people say we monkey around, but we're too busy singing to put anybody down.
We go where we want to. Sing from the Monkees is the greatest of all of them. That's number one.
Yes.
And I'm going to go from my personal favorites and the ones that I have the memories of, and then the ones that I can remember charting. But the Monkees,
yep.
The Munsters, the Flintstones, Bugs Bunny, or Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Show, since you and I are always singing it anyway.
Of course.
Beverly Hillbillies, Green Acres.
And Beverly Hillbillies, before we leave that one, I mean, you're talking about Flatt and Scruggs, who were playing that. I mean, these are top musicians and top composers in that bluegrass realm. That was a hell of a good song.
My Three Sons of Bitches. Bonanza. Underdog.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The Alvin Show.
Well, and back up for just a second, because Bonanza has another interesting, noteworthy piece of television theme song history to it, because the Bonanza theme song has lyrics, but they weren't written until after the show became a hit.
Hoss and Joe and Adam know every rock and pine. No one works, fights, or eats like those boys of mine. Here we stand in the middle of a grand bonanza. With a gun and a rope and a hat full of hope, we planted our family tree. We got a hold of a pot full of gold bonanza. With a house full of friends with a rainbow ends, how rich can a fella be?
So it was already out there. It was a piece of music, and then somebody went, oh, wait a minute, I can probably write some words to that thing.
Famous and popular theme songs of all time that people forget does have an actual name and does have lyrics. Theme from MASH, Suicide is Painless.
Suicide is Painless, which if you saw the movie, they sing the song.
Right. Love is All Around, a.k.a. theme from the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yeah.
I mean, we could be here all night, but okay. The ones that I remember charting, theme from Happy Days.
Yes.
Make Our Dreams Come True, the theme from Laverne and Shirley.
Right, which was right after Happy Days.
By John Sebastian from Welcome Back, Cotter.
Uh-huh.
Theme from The Rockford Files.
Also charted, right?
The annoying theme from Greatest American Hero.
I was just about to hit The Greatest American Hero.
Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. I never thought I could feel so free. Flying away on a wing and a prayer. Who could it be? Believe it or not, it's just me.
Yeah, here's an interesting one for you. I'm sure you know this, but the song Makin' It by David Naughton. who you remember, of course, was the star of
American Werewolf in London.
Right. And the star of the Dr. Pepper.
Yeah, I'm a Pepper, he's a Pepper ads. Yeah. Right.
Bacon It became a hit after it was used in the movie Meatballs, but it was actually the theme song of a very, very short-lived show with David Naughton in 1977 called Making It on ABC.
Okay.
So that's – but it took 2 years for that song to actually become something on a fluke, really.
Now, let me hit you with a couple that I actually have on my Amazon Prime or whatever the hell it is when my phone plays music in the car for me that come up in rotation every so often. The theme from Taxi, which is called – it's a woman's name. Angie is the name of that song. With the flute solo, that one, and probably what in my mind is the greatest piece of music of all time that was ever in front of a TV show.
Theme from Barney Miller?
No, you know, that's a great one.
That's something the Punchline used to use as its warm-up, believe it or not.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great tune, and I love playing that one, too. I mean, every bass player in the world started by learning that. Boom, ba-da-dum. But no, Quincy Jones is the one who gave us the theme song for Sanford and Son.
That's true.
And what a kick-ass song that is. And that kind of droning noise, it almost sounds like a didgeridoo that goes all the way through that, is actually a bass harmonica. And I didn't even know there was such a thing until I asked somebody. I was like, what is that sound in the Sanford and Son? That kind of wah, wah. Yeah, that's what it is. It's a bass harmonica. Very cool piece of music.
Pretty dummy.
Yeah, you big dummy. I'm coming, Elizabeth. Oh, man. What genius.
Theme from the Partridge Family, the original one.
Yeah.
Come On, Get Happy, but When We're Singing.
Yep.
The first season version. God, the fucking Brady Bunch. Love American Style by the Cow Sills.
Love, love, love. Well, and the, what was it? Sherwood Schwartz, was he the one that had all of the songs that would tell the story of the entire show in 30 seconds?
In a 3-hour tour, a 3-hour tour.
Right. Yes, indeed. And, you know, another one that they wrote lyrics to later, I mentioned Bonanza. That was a song, and then they wrote the words to it. The I Love Lucy theme, because
I Love Lucy and She Loves Me.
Right.
Something really silly and innocuous like that.
And Desi performed that in a show in the show. So when they went to the Copacabana or whatever the hell it was,
where she announces she's having a baby.
I think you're right. Where famously they could not say the word pregnant on the air.
Well, even on a cartoon like the Flintstones, Fred and Wilma didn't sleep in the same bed.
Right. Right. Yeah. In fact, the first couple that did was the Munsters, and they only got away with it because they weren't human.
And because they were dead.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Because I think Lily went to sleep sitting straight up.
Yep.
Oh, wait a minute. Another couple of great theme songs. Car 54, Where Are You? And of course, My Mother, the Car.
Oh. Starring Jerry Van Dyke.
And Miss Ann Southern, yeah, as the porter. Yep. And of course, Avery Schreiber.
Oh, yeah, right. You know, okay. So now we go from Avery Schreiber to Richard Benjamin because of a movie called The Scavenger Hunt.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Goodbye Columbus or one of those silly movies that he did in the 70s, which led up to him doing, of course, Quark.
Exactly, right. And following that, Dick Benjamin was in Saturday the 14th.
Don't know that movie.
It was a horror movie spoof because, you know, the Friday the 13th movies had come out. So they did Saturday the 14th, and he was the patriarch of this family that moves into the haunted house. His daughter was Carrie Michelson. Carrie Michelson then went on to star with Nell Carter. She was the oldest daughter in Gimme a Break.
Gimme a Break?
Yes. So, yeah, there's, and then, you know, that was one of those where the star of the show, Nell Carter, sang the theme song.
Yep. Now let me think. What other shows were there that...
How about Soap?
I was, you know, it's funny. I was just thinking of Soap, but you know what automatically came back to me? All in the Family, Maude, sung by Donny Hathaway.
Yeah.
And the Jeffersons, and then the theme from Good Times, all the Norman Lear shows.
And you missed one. How about Phyllis?
I don't really remember Phyllis.
That was Cloris Leachman.
I remember the show. What I'm saying is, I don't remember the theme to it.
It was one of those that was kind of a ripoff of the Mary Tyler Moore theme, where they're singing about what a great and powerful woman she is, and at the end, the punchline is Phyllis. It sure isn't you. So you know, and then that she gives this look into the camera.
Rhoda didn't have a vocal theme song, did she?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Phyllis was not as popular as Rhoda was.
No, and Phyllis only lasted like 3 or 4 seasons, and it just kind of died. But I always liked the theme song. It was pretty funny.
See, that's the thing. It's funny, though. We're in an era where we don't have theme songs per se, but oddly enough, like when I'm waiting for the ferry, there's very often a string quartet, and they play some wonderful renditions of things. They do the theme from Game of Thrones, which is immensely popular, and the minute they started, because it's a very distinctive piece, the first time I heard it, people were laughing and they're cheering at the same time when they heard it, you know.
Yeah,
people slightly clap after each song, but they were going bonkers with this one.
Right, and cable is the only place you'll see that, either on pay cable like Game of Thrones, or well, how about The Americans with that great auto harp hit right at the beginning of it.
Yep, that kind of weird.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what? Had a couple of really great things. Quinn Martin Productions, the FBI. Right?
Yep.
And you know what's another great one? I Spy.
Yes, I Spy for the FBI. And you know, if Clue Gulager isn't in these things, it's just not right. All right, my man.
Well, Lost in Space. Oh. That's another one that had a great theme.
Yes. Well, this is one I know we're going to have a ton of them in the comment section below. So if you have one that we missed, I know there's probably 50 of them that we've missed, but if you can think of one, then by all means, pop it up there for us. And Rob Ross, it looks like it's about that time, my man. So I will talk to you a week from today.
All right, brother. Stay well. Feel well. Stay warm and dry in case more snow comes.
Yeah, you too.
I will talk to you soon. Have a great week, okay?
You too, man. Take care.
Bye-bye.